Okay, everyone, welcome back to another episode of Music with Matt, the Map Podcast. My name is John.
And I'm Wes.
And so happy to have you here again, listening away. And we're going to continue with our feature on producers. And
that was a delay effect for
me. I was going to say, that's like a bit of a production note there. I like that, yeah. So, Wes, what we need here is we need kind of a quiet, sort of creepy version of the word producers. Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, we're going to continue focusing in on the role of a producer in the context of music, right? A producer in general, you know, I think folks can understand what that would be, but for us, we're going to focus in on music.
Yeah, and last time you brought a producer to the table.
Yes, Dave Otero, yeah.
And we talked a bit about some of his stuff, listened to a few of the production elements, talked a bit about just like mixing metal music and producing metal music and the extreme skill and ear that that takes to do in a very effective manner. Because, again, just to recap, like adding so many loud sounds, it is hard to like have a clean... everything sound clean and be able to hear like, ooh, that guitar is doing this,
yeah,
or the bass is doing that, or look at like listen to those drums,
yeah,
without everything just like slamming you in the face and
for sure
not able to differentiate any sound.
Like there's a set amount of real estate, audible real estate that's available, and when you have a kajillion things going on, it's like, where do these things fit in? I always think about that actually with visual art. You know, sometimes when you look at visual art, and oftentimes the album artwork for metal bands, the images are so busy. They have images within images within images, and that's just indicative of the sound as well, right?
Yeah.
As opposed to the sparsity of other types of art or music or anything like that. So anyway, that was a lot of fun for me with doing the Dave Otero, because again, I've always loved his work. One thing I thought I should have done actually is focused on some of the stuff he worked on like earlier in the 2010 decade, because a lot of the stuff I did was kind of towards the end and more recently released. Where it's kind of funny because like anyone who works in music, as time goes on, not only do you get better, but like your gear gets better. And all the bands that he works with, like their gear gets better. They have bigger budgets probably for their studio time. So they're able to like record more and focus in on more. And the end product will naturally sound better versus a group who's maybe like just kind of starting out and they have just whatever they have available in terms of like time resources, money resources, and equipment and things like that, right? So I thought actually in retrospect, I should have maybe pulled up some earlier examples and compared those, because it would have been interesting to hear like the sort of production notes by comparison.
But also like how, you know, like any musician, the more you play, you know, like unequivocally, the better you get, but like just the more stylings and the more voicings and the more phrasings you learn. And it's the same for production too. The more techniques you learn on adding different pieces of outboard gear or mixing something in a certain way, or because you just learn things from other people, learn things from experience. And all, and this all goes into, you know, your creative practice, right?
Yeah. And speaking of experience.
Yeah.
Before we started recording, you mentioned that this, you had said the producer that you would like to focus in on today is arguably one of the most influential producers like ever in music.
Well, I will say this,
it's a big statement.
This, guy, he's tied for the most, top 100 Billboard songs for like a production credit with George Martin, who obviously did all of the Beatles stuff.
Right.
Right. So he's got 23 songs that he's produced that have made Billboard top 100. Which is tied for the most out of anybody. And he is third most in terms of songwriter who has written songs in the top 100.
Okay.
The first and second person is Paul McCartney and John Lennon.
Okay.
Also from the Beatles.
Bit of a central theme here. Beatles.
Yeah. So outside of the Beatles.
So yeah, if you shelve the Beatles, this guy's it.
Has more production credits and more songwriting credits than anybody else in the history of pop music.
And let me clarify something too. So George Martin only worked with the Beatles.
No, he worked with other people, but his hit all of those songs
the
were
lion's
Beatles
share
songs.
Is, okay. Yes. And so the reason why he's there is predominantly the Beatles. So his credit is not because of really any other artists. But the Beatles, even though he did work with other artists. Okay.
Absolutely.
Now, does this person, do they share a similar type of like, you know, working legacy? Did they find their fame with just one artist, or is it spread over multiple artists? Or
so I think this person really encapsulates the role of a producer in modern music.
Right.
This person got started in the 90s and continues to work to today. and like I said, has like predominantly writes the song for an artist and says, here's my demo, sing it exactly as I sang it and I'll produce it for you.
Wow.
And he's written songs for, let me just get the, I have to reference my,
hold on, do I know who this is? Drum roll, please. Yeah.
This is Max Martin.
Max Martin. I don't know that name.
Right. And most people don't because he's never done anything. He's never been like an artist himself.
Right.
Unlike, and unlike most producers nowadays in a lot of pop music and things like that, you hear about them because they're featured on tracks, because they can sing, because they can play instruments.
Like Pharrell came to mind right away.
Like, and this guy has an incredible singing voice, by the way.
Oh, interesting.
But
which is why he's like, when I give you a demo, like, don't change the singing.
Don't change a single thing. So he like started with Backstreet Boys, NSYNC, and Britney Spears.
Okay.
Three of his early artists when he was working, and he was like 22 when he started working with the Backstreet Boys.
Backstreet Boys, NSYNC, and
Britney Spears.
Britney Spears. So that's all the same time.
Yes, but he also has written like top hits for Bryan Adams, Celine Dion, Robin, Bon Jovi, Kelly Clarkson, Christina Aguilera, Carrie Underwood, Usher, Pitbull, Nicki Minaj, Pink, Ed Sheeran, Lady Gaga, Coldplay, Adele, Taylor Swift, The Weeknd, Katy Perry, Justin Bieber, Ariana Grande,
Lizzo. So it's easier for you to name the people he hasn't worked with.
I could keep going, right? Like, this is the reality, though, that this person has written all of these songs for all of these major, major recording artists who are household names.
That's incredible.
Right?
Those are all huge names.
Over the last 30 years of music, right? Like, arguably the biggest bands and artists over the last 30 years in pop music.
Yeah.
And I'm also going to preface all of this by saying, none of this is really music that I gravitate towards for enjoyment.
Right.
Right? And I feel like oftentimes when we have these conversations and do these podcasts, I almost always like defend pop music too much, probably.
Well, yeah, right.
So there'll be a time when I actually get into music that I really enjoy listening to for the sake of what it makes me feel inside. But if we're looking at the art of production, Max Martin is like at the top of his game.
Right.
So,
and each of those artists that you mentioned, it's probably like thinking of the context of him working in the industry. I'm sure everybody that you mentioned is just in a queue waiting for him to become available to like work on a song, probably, right?
At this point in his career, yes.
Yeah, it's like, it's not like he's going around shopping around being like, hey, Biebs, do you want to sing on this track? Justin Bieber's like, finally, Max Martin called me, you know?
Well, and it's interesting too, because like we look at where... So he's from Sweden. He's Swedish.
Okay.
Sweden.
I think I do know.
Sweden has like a ridiculous amount of professional musicians and mainly songwriters that come from there. And a lot of it stems from what I've read and what I've come to understand is a lot
national healthcare. Just kidding. Well,
free education.
They
do support a lot of free education. Okay. And they have all of these music schools available for young people in Sweden that are able to explore playing music for free.
And just like cultivating the skill of like music, whatever that is, production, playing,
playing, production, all of these things. And so this is sort of where he came from, and then, you know, was a high school dropout, started playing in bands, and then was just in the right place at the right time to be able to Backstreet Boys stumbled into his door as a 22-year-old, and he's like, yeah, sure, I'll produce this album.
Right.
But he also wrote those songs.
Right.
Right. So that's the difference. Like the one of the famous stories is with Britney Spears, the song Hit Me Baby One More Time, right? Right away there's an instrumental hook.
Yeah.
Right? And the first like three notes of the song are so memorable that you're gonna walk away from that song at least singing that right away.
When did that song come out? It's still embedded in my brain. You know?
Yeah, it was like late 90s, I think 99.
Yeah, so there you go.
But he wrote that song, and he sang it exactly as she sings it on the record, and that was the first like sort of like famous story of Max Martin being like, no, don't do your version of my song, do my song.
Yeah.
Right?
Hey, Brittany, I couldn't help but notice in that last take you sort of did your own interpretation. Yeah. No. Here's the thing. Yeah.
And so actually that song was, he first wrote it for TLC, and he did four-part harmonies. Like just all himself. And they said it wasn't for them. So then he shopped it around to Robin, which was a massive
also
pop
huge,
star
yeah,
in
yeah,
that
yeah.
time. And also turned it down. Also from Sweden.
Right.
And then Britney Spears was just getting started. So she took it on. And lo and behold, it's one of the most successful, in terms of commercial success, pop songs of all time.
Yeah.
So it's this like fascinating sort of... element of what production is, where he writes the song, he does the melodies, he does the harmonies. He like obviously did a demo version and then collaborates with other musicians to create the soundscape that is the final piece.
But these are all extensions of his vision, his initial idea.
Yeah.
And also I think that, and this is something I believe that we've touched upon before, but also like, you know, the role of the producer is to find the people that gel well with that idea. Like, you could probably find a guitar player anywhere, but I'm sure he's like, no, the way that this person plays serves this song very well. And the same thing with, I'm sure when he was shopping it around, he wasn't thinking of just anybody. I could see the similarities. Certainly even look at Robin and Britney Spears. Yeah. You could see the similarities between the two. So he's like, okay, if not Robin, I'll try Britney Spears because they're, you know, the vocal timbre, the sort of their general, like, they're very different, but they're just female pop icons. So it's like, in that sense, you're like, I need this type of a person to sing this song. That also is the role of the producer.
And it's interesting too, you know, that song was shopped around and some artists said no or whatever. Like there is an interesting relationship with lyrical content and melodic hooks. Because I would say what makes Max Martin great and like good at what he does is his ability to write melodic hooks,
right?
Not even necessarily melodies. Like you just did that Britney Spears hook. That's three notes.
Yeah,
and yet it's so memorable.
Yeah, starts the song off like right away, just registers in your brain. Yeah.
So like on that conversation, I'm gonna play the very beginning of a song by The Weeknd called "Blinding Lights," massive pop hit, and the instrumental hook happens in the first 20 seconds of the song.
Right,
and then right away, you almost don't even need to know.
You almost don't even need to know
the rest of the song without like that's there, and like that's such a trait of. So here we go.
I love that sub bass.
Yeah, it is nice. Here it comes.
Yeah.
Oh, that bass is incredible. And then we go right into the song, right?
Right.
Like, but that musical hook, it's not complicated at all.
No.
And it's done. In the first 20 seconds, now the listener knows. And when that chorus is going to come back, I can all of a sudden sing along without ever having heard this song before.
Yeah.
Right. And so there's an art to that. Like there's a very like big creative skill to like being able to write that and rewrite it until it like you find what works.
Absolutely.
And then the instrumentation comes in and the sounds and all these other things. But
yeah,
didn't mean to play that there.
No. And it's interesting because I also think about like not the polar opposite, but think of like a nursery rhyme. You know, those melodies are so just basic and straight and to the point, and they serve that same purpose. They're easy to sing along. They kind of land in your brain, and they'll stay there for a while and stuff like that. But sort of like in the context of writing a pop song for everybody, including adults and things like that, it's actually kind of hard to be like, how can I make something that is simple, that's going to register with people in their brain, but at the same time can't just be so simple you brush it away? Or like, you know, it's such a fine line between getting something that still will succeed as a attractive and what's the word I'm trying to think of? Like a melody that just lands with someone, you know, in a way where it's like alluring, it's attractive, and someone listens to it goes like, oh, this is awesome.
But it's simple, right?
But it's still simple.
Yeah.
And it's like, you're not going to listen to it and go like, oh, this sounds like a nursery rhyme.
It's accessible in that way.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's like that is truly a talent to be able to like find something that is effective, but still very simplistic and to the point. And again, almost like a nursery rhyme melody, but it doesn't come across that way.
Yeah.
You know?
And you go through his whole discography, all of those artists, all of the top songs that he's written for those artists all do the same thing.
Right.
Within the first 30 seconds of the song, you know the melodical hook.
Yeah.
Like as the listener, and you're able to sing along with it the next time that chorus comes
in. Right.
Right. So like that's, you know, say whatever you want about it, formulaic, all these other things, whatever. And there's an element to that, absolutely.
Sure.
Right? And there's a reason why a lot of these artists kind of sound similar to one another, because Max Martin's written all their songs. But it's that idea of being able to, like, you know, the idea of fishing, right? Like, you hook the fish, and then you barely have to, like, reel it in after that point, because it's on, right?
Yeah.
So that's, like, a really interesting element of what Max Martin does. And then another thing that I really appreciate about his production style, and just like the pop production style that a lot of people do, but Max Martin really does as well, is the idea of a pre-chorus.
Interesting.
Right? Like, it's the setup to the big drop and like that melodical hook coming back.
Yeah.
Because like as the audience, we're waiting for it now.
Right? Yeah, it's just only a matter of time before it comes back. Yeah.
But the verse happens and the verse is, you know, usually a little bit more mellow, and there's always that sort of like with Max Martin songs, there's always that constant beat in the background.
Sure,
that,
sure.
That doesn't change with any of his music. But the pre-chorus that like is just interesting enough to like switch it up a bit, to then land that chorus in a more profound way than just right. simply from going to the verse right back into the chorus right. would be. Right.
Without that contrast, you wouldn't appreciate it as much.
So again, yeah. same song. Let's check out the pre-chorus.
I do enjoy a good pre-chorus.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
Because again, there's another art, like production art to that and songwriting art to that, where, because a typical like song structure, at least in Western music, verse, chorus, bridge, chorus, done.
Maybe double chorus to finish
right,
it off.
Exactly,
yeah.
right? But having a pre-chorus just adds that extra part of suspense before. It's almost like a bit of a tease, right?
Yeah.
Where it's like, you know, the chorus is coming back and I know you want to hear it, but we're going to just put this in here to make it more suspenseful.
Absolutely.
Right?
It's that dynamic contrast. Like, you know, obviously for me, I'll speak in the context of metal, but I've heard various metal artists say you can't have an album that's kind of like pushing it to 11 every song, because your super heavy songs get lost without the contrast yeah, of something yeah. that's maybe slower and more doomier, or even quiet and more melodic or something like that. Without yeah. that contrast, you don't fully appreciate. And it's funny. It's just a natural duality, light and dark, mm-hmm. whatever it might mm-hmm. be. Right. So it's just like that idea of, yes, this is the impact of the song. And in order for me to fully accentuate that, I will contrast it very mm-hmm. briefly mm-hmm. with something else before I send it home. And then as a listener, or an audience member, or whatever, the satisfaction when you're like, oh, here it is.
Well,
again.
Let's go.
Everybody's so just living yeah. for the choruses, you know.
So this song again, "Blinding Lights," has a fantastic pre-chorus that I love, and I like the verse. I actually like this song. I must confess.
Yeah.
Am I going to listen to it on repeat?
No.
Right. But first time I heard this song, I was just like, ah, it's actually pretty cool.
Like, this sounds great. Yeah.
So here, so we're gonna just carry on, just the tail end of the verse into the pre-chorus, and then once the chorus hits.
That bass.
Here's the pre-chorus. Here comes. Yeah, we're back in it. Right? And it's just that like little added suspense. Also just that vocal melody, like,
yeah.
But he knows how The Weeknd can sing, but also Max Martin can sing.
So yeah,
I picture like The Weeknd hearing this demo. I guess he doesn't go by The Weeknd anymore.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
days of the week. I don't know.
Weekdays.
Yeah.
Spelled with a Z.
Of course. Yeah.
No. I think he just goes by his real name now.
Tuesday.
But the point is just like that melody that we heard at the very beginning. Right. Just that once time through, just a little yeah. taste. We know how this song is going to go. And the lyrics are irrelevant.
Yeah.
I will say this. Like, if there's one thing I don't really love about pop music is lyrical content.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, part of it. And like to his defense, English is not his first language.
Right.
So when he's writing a song like "Hit Me Baby"
Ooh,
one
baby,
more time,
I feel so good.
But,
yeah.
But also "Hit Me Baby" one more time. Are you kidding me? You
yeah.
can write that here. Like yeah, that's, you know, there's allusions to domestic violence and all these other things and like all of this. But obviously that wasn't his intention when he wrote those words. And
yeah.
that's not what it means to him.
He was playing in a casino or something.
Yeah.
Like, "Hit Me
exactly,
Baby."
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. But that's the sentiment.
Yeah. He's like, hold on, wait, people think
yeah.
this is about domestic
violence. Yeah.
I was playing poker one night. This is
which is why they changed the name of the song to "One More Time." Dot dot
oh.
dot. One more time instead of "Hit Me Baby" one more time, because
right,
that's what it was
right,
originally
right,
called.
Right, right, right. Interesting.
But like the lyrical content of his whole body of work from when he started to now is very similar.
Sure.
And it's sort of vapid and you
of
know,
course
you
yeah
know, all of these things that goes along with pop music, which I think like takes away a lot from the actual song, unfortunately, for me at least.
Yeah.
As somebody who really appreciates lyrical content.
Of course, yeah, of course. But to me, I would almost say that that's, you can't fault.
Oh, absolutely
that,
not.
By definition, yeah, it's like the second you get a little spicy, you're going to alienate someone. 100%. The second you get a little dark, someone 100%. Goes, ooh, you know.
Yeah.
You got to keep it pretty
accessible,
less,
right? Absolutely. Fun, you know. Obviously, a song like this is kind of dark, right? The other weekend song that was really popular that he wrote, "I Can't Feel My Face,"
right?
Right. This song's all
excessive
about
cocaine
drug use. Yeah, absolutely, right? Like, and so there's dark themes here.
Yeah,
but ultimately, it's very surface, very party central.
Yeah.
Very like, you know, living a life of consumerism and high class and partying.
Well, and,
you know,
and it's like sort of to reiterate the point too. It's like it's funny how, if a song is captivating enough and a melody is captivating enough, someone will sing whatever the words are without
thing.
Even paying attention to it, because they're like, yeah, it's like, ooh, baby, I'm so sad right now.
Yeah, exactly.
I can't
right?
believe it, you know.
But it's a catchy melody,
yeah,
so you're
like,
singing along. And, and that's the best part, actually, is like, you know, you're driving in the car with somebody and like, again, by the second or third chorus, they're just singing along to whatever words
are
irrelevant.
Doesn't matter what it is,
but they're hitting the notes, right?
Yeah.
So that's the pre-chorus. It's something that maybe doesn't get talked enough about it.
It's true. No,
music.
It's like, I feel like it's a little bit of a, like the card up the sleeve, the trick up the sleeve a little bit in
especially
terms
when
of
we talk about songwriting, like
song dynamics.
Again,
yeah.
We often kind of don't bring that up enough, but,
well, and also like to that end too, like, that pre-chorus, you know, as a way of reiterating the point and accentuating that contrast at one point, the instrumentation dropped out and it was just drums and that vocals for like a couple bars and then bam, here comes the chorus. So it's like, what better way to create that kind of contrast than fully pulling away all the instruments but the voice and the drums and then kicking it back to the big chorus, which is what we're all kind of waiting for, right? As opposed to the alternative where it's like the music is fairly even keel and then it just rides right into the chorus and it's just like that effect is not, it gets lost, you know?
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the final things I really appreciate about Max Martin and like his idea of production and what he brings to production is he's really into the idea of collaboration, right? Like in a very North American and Western sense, like people love the idea that artists write their own songs.
Or it's just like, right? It's all me.
Especially
like,
pop artists like Taylor Swift writes her own songs, right? Because you can see her writing credit, and yet Max Martin's written most of her songs.
Right.
Most of her like big songs at least.
Or especially if it's just like, oh, they play like all their own instruments and things like that. And you're like,
Yeah. There's a pretty massive band.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure T. Swift wasn't getting behind the drum kit to like lay down some drums on whatever track.
But you know what? Like, if I'm wrong,
I apologize.
Yeah, I don't think that's a bad thing, right? Like, and one thing I like that Max Martin talks about in interviews and stuff, at least that I've read about him, he's like, yeah, this idea of collaboration is awesome. Like, that's what we should encourage in music, in songwriting,
right?
Absolutely. It's this very Western thing of like, we need this one individual to do everything and to be all of the parts of their music, right? Which the reality is like he equated it, I think, in one interview I read to a television show. Look how many writers write for a television show.
Yeah.
You know, an album's the same way.
Right.
Right. Maybe one day I've got a really good hook or I've got a really good bridge or like my verse is, I just feel so good about it. And we can collaborate and combine these things to create a record that's like
a masterpiece
from start to back, instead of just having like, you know, a couple songs here that like, you know, I wish this was a bit stronger or that, you know. So,
well, and even just like the natural kind of dynamic of being thinking creatively is sometimes someone might, I think about, you know, a handful of writers showing up one day to work and someone might be like, you know, I got this great melody line, but I don't know how to close it. I don't have like a hook for it or something like that. And then someone says, oh, I got this like pretty cool hook, but I got nothing else for it. And then they can kind of collaborate. And, you know, like even that's just like the beauty of collaboration and just the fact that certain people are good at different things. And the sum total will like always, not always, but in theory, the sum total will be much better than, someone working individually. And it's just also, those are some pretty big shoes to fill, you know.
But this is why pop music is popular, right?
Yeah.
You know, because so many people can digest it in a very accessible manner, right? For lack of a better term. And there's smarter people than me that could tell you more reasons why popular music is popular, and part of it's marketing streams and advertising.
Oh, it's all part of
it,
yeah.
But the reality is like a song like that, it's a catchy, good song.
Yeah, exactly.
Again, I'm not going to listen to it on repeat. It doesn't like hit me in the heartstrings where some of the music that I really, really love does.
Mm-hmm.
But I appreciate that for what it is, and it's pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like, it has the impact of, you could quite unknowingly say, I tend to use the analogy of, or the example of, you know, shopping in a grocery store. It's like you could go into the grocery store, hear that song, have it register likely unconsciously.
Yes.
And then when you're like walking away from the grocery store with your bag of groceries, yeah, just going, and just not even thinking about it.
Yeah.
Oh. And then someone walks by, you go, hey, that's the Weeknd.
Yeah.
Hey, Max Martin. Awesome. Yeah. I love that guy.
Right. But that, so one of the lesser known, but probably more affluent people in the music industry.
Oh, it sounds like it.
Because he's getting writing credits on all of this stuff.
Yeah. No, and that does sound, I couldn't really put the name to the face necessarily, but now that you've spoken about him and talked about,
but
like,
there's
all the
been
artists,
several big producers and songwriters from Sweden, because again of their free education for young people for these types of endeavors. But it's cool, and so again, this is, you know, to hear or to see like Billboard Top 100. What is that? Like, again, it's a popularity contest to a certain extent, but there's still like commercial relevancy and creative relevancy to that, you know, those songs, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
And to have that many on that list is pretty ridiculous.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Especially because he's turned labels several times and you know, collaborated with everybody and done different things and like, you know.
I wonder what like his average day looks like. Like, I just pictured, what kind of place does this guy live in? I mean, he would have multiple places, but like, you know. Was he just like wake up in the morning and be like, yeah, I just like make a French press and like read the news for a bit and then just write an absolute international pop sensation song and then just do it again like a week later or something like that?
Yeah.
Often summers we travel to lower Spain and you know, like just things like that. Yeah. Like, no, it's just funny to think about someone who has like such an exceptional talent and it's wild. And also to the point of just that idea of collaboration totally makes sense, but to flip that on its head and just focus on him specifically, it is just remarkable for someone like that to just be so good at that.
Mm-hmm.
I was gonna say that one thing, like there's so many levels to it, but for him to just find the stride and continue to reinvent the wheel for different people, different songs, where like fundamentally it's the same and yet each song is different, is just incredible. Like, what an incredible feat.
And that's it.
Know?
Like, the Backstreet Boys song to, you know, one of his more modern songs with Taylor Swift. Like,
even that Weeknd song.
Even
like,
the Weeknd song.
Next to the Backstreet
Boys.
In
essence, it's kind of the same thing. It, like, and that's, like, not to compare it to the Beatles, but they're the other group that sort of had the same space on that musical chart. Whereas throughout their career, they started with, like, this very bubbly pop, you know.
Yeah.
Stuff and they kind of like went into experimentation and then some all kinds of different stuff towards the end, but there was like, but they also reflected a lot of like the political ideologies that were transpiring at the time, through the 60s through the 70s, a lot of, you know, the drug culture, a lot of counterculture things. There was a lot of like you know, ties,
peripheral
but
things,
but there was also like, there was also like a journey with them as a group, whereas with Max Martin it's just kind of like, this is my thing, I crush it, and I'm still crushing it. So there, which is like an interesting thing to think about, and like these songs, who knows if they'll stand the test of time, and like if we look back on this in 50 years and be like, look at this guy's catalog, are you kidding me? Or if it's just like, I don't know, but
even that is kind of tricky because
of course
some of those, even the nature of the music industry at the time of the Beatles versus from the 90s till now, it's like they're it's hard to compare because they're so different.
They had the opportunity to be there at a certain point. Like once they hit, like they had the opportunity to go in the studio and mess around for months on end and create something like Strawberry Fields Forever. Right. Like,
And just to have
in a time when technology wasn't accessible for the average musician.
Yeah. It's just like they're so different. It's like, it is actually just genuinely hard to compare, but yeah, no, that's wild.
So Max Martin, that's definitely somebody who, when I think of a producer and their involvement in everything from the songwriting process to the recording process to the mixing process, and then just like behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Like nobody knows who he is, and yet everybody would know almost all of his big songs.
Right.
Which is just wild.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, you go on YouTube, you can't find Max Martin playing one of his own songs, you know, anywhere. Right. So it's interesting. So that, to me, like, this is like one of like the quintessential producer of I am behind the scenes. I am so involved in this song creation process. And yet the artist is the face.
Yeah.
And the artist is the one who performs and does it and all these things. And at that point, my hands are not no longer part of it. But
yeah. It's like you go talk to that massive crowd that loves your song. I'm just going to go back to Lower Spain and just vacation with my family again in solitude.
Exactly.
Because no one knows who I am.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's wild. Okay, but, there you go. Max Martin.
Producer part two.
Yeah. Thanks for listening, everyone. And stay tuned for more music with Matt, but certainly more producer-related episodes.
That's right.
Yeah.